Welcome to the Commonwealth Club, where we'll have Dr. Fasano give a talk on his research. It is such a treat to have him here. He is one of the leaders in looking at the role of the gut and how it affects our health, which it does. I mean, it can be the source of many conditions, autoimmune diseases and things from there on, and even like autism and schizophrenia. The research shows that the health of the gut plays a part. So he did research to develop a cholera vaccine in the late 1990s. He discovered a toxin called zonula occludens, which caused diarrhea by loosening the tight junctions in the gut, thus allowing permeability in the intestines, which is also referred to as leaky gut. Subsequently, his lab identified the protein zonulin, which controls the process of how the gut is permeable or not. He's established the role of zonulin in the pathogenesis of celiac disease and in the pathology of type 1 diabetes. He's currently investigating the compositions and change in the gastrointestinal microbiota to help determine why some individuals have an inherited predisposition to celiac disease and why they develop clinical diseases and why others do not. They're investigating the timing of gluten introductions to infants and the development of celiac disease, working to uncover a biomarker to develop a diagnostic tool for gluten sensitivity. Other research projects include links between gluten-related disorders such as schizophrenia, autism spectrum disorder in certain subgroups of patients. The latest research includes a focus on how gut microbiota is related to the development of autoimmune disease. With great pleasure, I introduce Dr. Fasano, who's from Harvard Medical School.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you so much. Do I need to do this or not? No. It's a great pleasure to be here, to share with you what's going on in a field that is very much, moving progress situation. And again, this is changing tremendously some dogmas and paradigms in science that we thought that were not going to change ever. The bottom line of what you're going to hear today, it's what are the few facts that we have with a lot of interpretation of why we as society are getting sicker and sicker and what we can do about it. And again, the role of nutrition that will be an easy and cheap fix is remarkably coming to the forefront of the scientific discussion of why we have these epidemics of many conditions and eventually what will be the best intervention. So the first very provocative message that I have to leave to you that has been a dogma that has been put under scrutiny lately is that the fact that we are born with specific genes that will make us at risk to develop conditions here is autoimmunity, but just change that with cancer or neurodegenerative disease and so on and so forth doesn't mean that this is destiny. In other words, if you got to the wrong or unfortunate draw the luck that you got these genes, that doesn't mean that sooner or later you will come down with these diseases. If you do or do not, strongly depends on your lifestyle. Matter of fact, the yin and yang between what the immune system does to defend us, that technically we call tolerance, or to attack possibly enemies that we call immune responses. Sometimes this immune response goes out of control, and that's the basis of all diseases that affect humankind. It's really something that, again, we had a minimal grasp in terms of how we eventually develop this kind of condition. And for my many years, I've been working on the premises that the recipe to develop this condition, again, autoimmune disease is what we're going to focus today, but take that and put chronic inflammatory disease, meaning any disease of humankind, is that you have to have genetic predisposition. And that's a given. It's a given also that you have to be exposed to an environmental trigger that is mismanaged by your immune system, that is, really designed and engineered to get rid of these enemies. But for problems that we still don't understand fully, when exposed to these enemies, people, they are predisposed for autoimmunity just rather than get rid of these enemies, start to attack their own body. And again, we have only minimal information on which specific environmental triggers really leads to this process of chronic inflammatory diseases, including autoimmune disease, with the exception of celiac disease, for which we know and we'll discuss a little bit more. Susan was alluding at some work there, line of work that we've done in terms of gut permeability and how important seems to be this now in the recipe of these chronic inflammatory diseases. Indeed, these two worlds, the gene that live within us and these triggers that come from the environment, so they're outside, at some point they have to physically interact. And to do that, they need to really cross these barriers that we have built, biologically speaking, to defend ourselves against these enemies. And as you will see in a moment, the intestine is the largest interface that we have with the environment. For sure, the immune system is part of this recipe. The immune system, again, is not working properly in situation in which we develop chronic inflammatory disease that leads to these pathologies. And, of course, the microbiome. This is a relatively new field. We were totally unaware of this parallel world that we live with that seems to influence tremendously how to cement all these other elements of the recipe that eventually will lead to the clinical outcome. Now, something that has been bothering a lot of scientists, particularly in this concept that the genetics is such a driver of this problem, is these epidemics of autoimmune diseases that we have been experiencing in the past 3-4 decades, particularly in industrialized countries. And this leads to what we call the IgA hypothesis. That stems from this observation that was made, a decade or so ago, in which, just taking a look at the literature, several investigators realized that, since the 50s, we've done a tremendously powerful job to really decrease the burden of infectious disease in humankind. That you see on the left-hand side, how with the advent of better hygiene or antibiotics and so on and so forth, diseases that had high tax of morbidity and mortality, like rheumatic fever, TB, hepatitis, mumps, measles, they really, really dropped. And that was really the consequence of, knowing much more what this condition were all about and develop strategies, again, active intervention and treatment like antibiotics or very powerful preventive intervention like vaccines to really decrease the burden of this condition. However, during exactly the same timeline, and you see this on the right, we witnessed this epidemics of autoimmune diseases like MS, Crohn's, type 1 diabetes, asthma, and many others are following the same kind of trend. Well, this was called the IgA hypothesis because, interestingly, this phenomenon was happening only in industrialized countries. So the countries of the northern hemisphere, if you wish, you see down there on the right, left-hand side in red, the countries in which these infectious diseases were really decreasing, and now they are experiencing this surge of autoimmune diseases, while the one in the lower hemisphere, the one here, they had no autoimmune diseases, but they still have this problem with infections. And that's how they come up with this idea of the IgA hypothesis. But I want to really reiterate the concept. The timeline that we're talking about here, 50 years, is such a short time that definitely we cannot advocate genetic mutation as responsible for these epidemics. Rather, it seems like that we're changing the environment so fast that we cannot adapt, and therefore we pay a price for this. And again, this hypothesis has been up for a long, long time until the recent past, in which there's been some observation that put this hypothesis in question. And mainly, this has been the observation that now hygiene has been improving in some of these developing countries, North Africa, South America, and therefore they don't see these epidemics of infectious disease anymore. Yet they do not see the epidemics of autoimmunity as we do in Western countries. So there must be something else that really is driving these epidemics that, again, cannot be the genetic mutation. It takes centuries to advocate genes mutation to be responsible for this increase, prevalence of these diseases. But yet, it's not just the fact that we have been getting too clean for our own goods to be responsible for these epidemics. What we're talking about, well, this is something that's not, you know, trivial. Just one of them, just to talk about the epidemics of diabetes, in only, 15 years, we've seen an increment of diabetes worldwide that is really out of proportion. So really, this is going out of control. Again, we had an increment of 70 million people, so 46% worldwide only in 15 years. And the projection on long run is even worse. So we are talking about something that really will really impinge tremendously on the quality of life and the timeline of life, no matter what you're looking at. And again, this is proving that now we're in a global village of these epidemics. There is no place spared anymore. And we see this not only in diabetes, but many other conditions. For example, here, celiac disease. We have the same kind of evidence. At the beginning, we thought this was just an increase of awareness. Nobody knew about celiac disease. Now that we know more, we look for it, and therefore we discover more cases. But when you start to, follow healthy cohorts, like, the graph in the upper left corner there, for 50 years, these are healthy adults, have been same people, followed for 50 years, you see that celiac disease doubled every 15 years. So this is really, worrisome. And Susan was mentioning our work on autism. That probably is the most remarkable and frightening situation that we're facing. In only 25 years, we passed from 1 in 5,000 to 1 in 68. 25 years. And if you consider that male-female ratio of the autistic spectrum disorder is 4 to 1, that means the next generation, 1 out of 4 boys, will be out of commission because of autism. This is disgraceful. And this is worrisome. And that's the reason why this takes a tremendous amount of work from many individuals that with the humility should sit around the table and try really to get a sense of what's going on. The problem with autism, like with diabetes, these are very, very complicated disease to study because there are many variables that we do not control. This condition, celiac disease, is probably the one that will bring us home run. And the reason why, that contrary to the many other conditions, we know so much about celiac disease that we don't for other immune-mediated diseases that are in the same, trend of epidemics. Again, there is a genetic predisposition like any other immune disease, and there is a peculiarity. There are some genes that must be present in celiac disease without which you don't develop it. They are called HLA genes. There are two of them, DQ2 and DQ8. You have to have either or both develop celiac disease. Without those, practically impossible to develop celiac disease. So that's unique. The such high penetrance of these genes, they are associated to autoimmunity. It's non-parallel to any other conditions. There are other conditions which the penetrance is 70-75%. Here we're talking about pretty much 100%. The other peculiarity, again, is that the environmental trigger, the one that caused the problem, is the only one that is known in celiac disease as gluten, the strange protein from grains. We don't know what makes people sick with diabetes, with autism, or MS. But we know undisputably that gluten is the driving force for this. So we can do stuff with celiac disease that we cannot with the others. And the goal is, once we understand the machinery, how you really end up to develop celiac disease, probably we'll be able to extrapolate some of this information to really get a sense of what's going on with these other epidemics. Now, talking about, trying to figure out which factors are driving the epidemics of celiac disease, many people have been, postulating maybe the quantity of gluten or the quality of gluten that we're eating is different than in the past, the time of gluten introduction, the maturity of the intestine, its function to protect us is not quite there, and we look all this. And again, these are very difficult studies to do because in general what we do is what we call technically retrospective studies. So we go back in the literature and we interrogate, these folks that develop celiac disease, did they eat more gluten? Did they eat a different kind of gluten? And it's very difficult really to pinpoint the right direction. The best way that is the most, cost-effective but extremely painful way to do this is to do prospective long-term studies. So take a cohort of infants at risk of serious disease and follow over time, and then try to figure out, you know, who developed serious disease, who did not, and then try to make a sense, would they make different, these kids that developed the disease? I talk about kids because, again, the other advantage to study serious disease compared, let's say, MS, is that we know that there is a critical mass of individuals that would develop serious disease early in life, in the first 10 years of life. Of course, you can develop serious disease, that now we know, at any age of life, but the vast majority, they do so very early. And we just published this paper last year that did exactly that, follow a large cohort, almost, you know, 800 kids from birth, you know, over time, to try to figure out, you know, what really makes these kids to develop serious disease. In other words, what puts these kids over the edge and develop the problem. And again, these kids were recruited at birth and followed for 10 years. So, you know, this is a very, very difficult, but the only, you know, way to really get a sense of what's going on. And the 10 years of work boiled down to a major disappointment. So we still don't know what makes these kids sick. With something that we know, that a lot of hypotheses that we put on the table turned to be wrong. For example, we thought that if you introduce gluten in a specific window that we call window intolerance, between 4 to 7 months, based on this retrospective study, you got a best shot to minimize the risk. It didn't work. We thought that breastfeeding, that is instrumental for many functions of humankind, was going to protect you know, these kids from serious disease. Unfortunately, did not. We thought that if we introduce a very small amount of gluten early in life, like to give a sort of vaccine to re-educate the immune system, will help. It did not. We also thought, well, maybe that delaying after a year age, so that we give the time of the immune system to learn who is friend, who is foe, would be a good way to go. It did not work. The thing that really pinned out, the only two things that really pinned out, was that infections of first year life seem to have a trend to increase risk, and definitely genetics play a major role, and we knew that, but now we have more grasp of what that means. So while the prevalence of serious disease in the general population is roughly 1%, it goes to 10% if you're a first family member of somebody with serious disease, and that was also known. What's interesting is that the genes that I told you are necessary to be there, and any genes you can have, you know, three possible scenarios. You don't have it. You have one copy of it, so what we call heterozygous. So you have two copies because you got both from mom and dad, that copy, and so you're homozygous. So if you're homozygous for one of these HLA DQ2, your risk goes all the way to 40%. So clearly the genetic does, you know, plays a tremendous role. And the other thing that we learned is that during these 10 years, this epidemic is continuing. So we saw during these 10 years a continued trend of increase of the prevalence, in this case, the incidence of serious disease over time. So bottom line, this brought us to back to the drawboard board and say, okay, what else is going on here? And that's when roughly 6 years ago, we start really to look into the microbiome as a possible additional problem that, you know, was impinging on the story. Now, just as a personal background, you know, as a career, and Susan alluded to it, I've been always involved in trying to understand how microorganisms crosstalk with us and how we interface. And at that time, we didn't call it microbiome. We called ecosystem of the gut. And at that time, you know, we were focused on a single individual. In my case, Vibrio cholerae, that's, you know, it's something that still we pay a dear price. And then, you know, in learning how this microorganism interface and talk with us, I learned a great deal of lessons, including, you know, the one that Susan was alluding to. How by learning mechanism that, you know, microorganisms used to, you know, deploy their weaponry, how we work in terms of physiology. So this toxin that we identify in Vibrio led us to discover zonulin and opening a new paradigm of this, you know, gut permeability and so on and so forth. Anyhow, I don't want to go too technical because it's not the right audience, but it suffices to say that now you read about this microbiome everywhere. So a little thing that is would be appropriate to know is that, again, we are talking about a very, very sophisticated ecosystem. I like to call this as a parallel world that live with us. They have their own rules. They have their own, you know, developmental, you know, goals. These folks, by the way, are extremely smart. They've been around millions and millions of years before the humankind was, you know, even on the face of the earth. When we will self-destroy ourselves, they will continue to live on the earth. So these people, they know what they're doing. Even if it seems to be disgusting, we're made by many more microorganisms than our own cells, with a ratio 10 to 1. That means that, you know, the genome of this microorganism outsource ours by a ratio 150 to 1. So these folks combine, they generate 150 times more genes than we do as a species. There are very, very diversified species of microorganisms in the gut, but in our body in general. We were totally unaware about this because the vast majority, more than 95%, cannot be cultured. So in other words, you can't take a petri dish and see the colony. They cannot be cultured. So we're completely, totally unknown to us. We were naive of the presence of this complex ecosystem that we live with. And again, and the other thing that, again, will be interesting, not that, again, you need to know this, but there's a hierarchy of these folks. And when we read the microbiome, some people, they don't appreciate the complexity of the matter, because then when you go on the practical terms, that, okay, now we don't know the microbiome, now we can fix it with the probiotics, prebiotics, and so on. Wait a second. It's not that easy. You know, if you look at the scale of the classification here, you know, the best that we can do right now in this microbiome studies, the vast majority that we read in the literature, is at the phylum level. So it's like to say, okay, start from domain, this is the universe, the kingdom is the Milky Way, the phylum is the solar system, the class is Earth, the order is California, the family is San Francisco, the genus is this neighboring, the species is the building where we are in. And if you want intelligibly discuss with Susan, you can't say, okay, I'm going to work at the Milky Way level. There is no way. You got to go to the species level. And very rarely we're able to do that. Why? Because, again, 95% of these folks cannot be cultivated. So when you read this, you know, be aware that the information that we are right now is to just to create the background and the foundations to really capitalize on what is going to be the future of, you know, intervention based on what is the composition of the microbiota. The only thing that we can do now, right now, is to look at the composition, particularly the phylum level, and there are two orders of levels that we call Firmicutes and Bacteroidetes that it needs to be in balance. But the rule is, that, you know, we were discussing this morning actually with a friend, this is on there, is that we know now that if the microbiota is virally composed, so in other words, there is a variation of inhabitants in the gut, that's a good thing. When they become more homogeneous, so in other words, that means there are few phyli that are taking over, that's a bad thing. That's typically associated to negative outcome. That as much as we know. And again, the rest is going to be all an intriguing ride of science that we're doing now. You have to appreciate that this is not easy. Even the complexity of the data that we have to deal with is mind-blowing. You know, the human genome project that was to decode the human genetics, it took almost 2 decades. Now we're talking about 150 times more complex. Not only that, it changes all the time. All the time. Because our genome does not. But these folks, they change all the time. So this is just to appreciate how difficult it really is to understand what's going on. And again, without going too much in details, we know there is a storm that starts when we're born. And, you know, without, again, going in these technical details, just suffice to say that at the beginning, it's chaos, total chaos. because you go from the wounds to the external world. You go from a certain feeding through the placenta to another feeding, and depending what feeding we're talking about, you know, breastfeeding or bottle feeding, there's going to be so many differences, and so on and so forth. And then when you turn 4 or 6 months old, solid food is introduced, and all this reflects in a tremendously dynamic change of the microbiome that's settled by the end of the first year. It should settle, I should say, by the end of the first year, if everything goes all right. And then from there on, it's all what we do as an individual, as lifestyle, if we keep this microbiome in balance, that typically means that we stay healthy, or we put this off balance and this create problems. There is another thing that is important, you know, that we can study now, and we were not able to do only 2 years ago. When we talk of the microbiome, it's just simply saying who is there. So in other words, we can really establish who is living with us. But that's not what is important. What is important is what kind of language this microorganism can talk. Can they talk English, French, Polish, Italian, Russian, you know, Arabic? What kind of language? That means what kind of genes they have that can eventually use to communicate with us. And even more importantly, is what are they talking about? So which of these genes are expressed so they can communicate with us? And that really affects who we are as a human being. This is a very, very provocative thought, but this is what science is going. Now, of my 40, maybe 50 minutes I have to talk with you, probably this is the most important slide that I have. So if you really give me a minute of your attention, this is the essence in what I think the field is going. And again, I'm talking about not autoimmunity. I'm talking about any kind of disease that can affect humankind. If you're lucky, you're on the left side of this slide. You're born as Mother Nature decided that we have to be born by vaginal delivery. You're fed what we were supposed to be fed as a species and not what we're eating right now, particularly in our latitudes, because that's not food. No or few infections, particularly in the early part of life, and no antibiotic treatment. If you do all this, you have a microbiome composition that will be in balance. What that means? It means a lot. Because the microbiome, particularly in the first 2-3 years of life, that does a lot of things. But the key function is to train our immune system to fight. If the microbiome is in balance, the immune system will be instructed to set the bar to unleash weapons that will lead eventually to this collateral damage that we call inflammation extremely high. So only when we are under tremendous danger. Remember, the immune system, when it was engineered 2.5 million years ago, was built to fight one and only one enemy, infections. Our species will die either because infected or ate by a predator. That's it. There was nothing else. Now the immune system has to fight many other enemies, pollutants, radiation, chemicals, cancer, because that's what the immune system does for a living. Not at that time. So once again, you want this bar high enough to unleash inflammation when really we are under danger. And if we do that, so we train our immune system to really function that way, we are in what we call a state of tolerogenic response, meaning we stay healthy. If you're unlucky, you're on the right side of this slide. You're born by C-section, so there is no imprinting of mom's microbiome on us, and I will tell you in a moment what that means. You're fed what we feed our kids nowadays. That, you know, if you ask yourself what is in that plate, sometimes you don't have any idea because you don't buy something from scratch most of the time. Or if you do, you don't know where it's coming from. And we don't have the quote-unquote time to cook anymore. That is disgraceful. You know, I really truly believe that if you organize to yourself, 20 minutes is more than enough, so that's very much an excuse. We are bombarded by many infections, and most importantly, we use and abuse antibiotics. All this puts the microbiome off balance. What that translates, that bar to unleash inflammation is set very low. For minimal reasons, the immune system will really deploy weapons, and that creates this inappropriate immune response that on a specific genetic background will make you to develop food allergies, asthma, autoimmune diseases, cancers, neurodegenerative diseases, you name it. And that's the only way that you can explain the epidemics of these conditions that we face. True, we live longer, and therefore we have more time to develop these problems. But these problems sometimes materialize at an age like 30, 40, or for some autoimmune diseases like celiac disease in childhood. That has nothing to do with the fact that we're living longer. So why we believe that the immune system is trained by the microbiota, and why we believe that the microbiota is so important for our health? Well, we don't have, you know, definite proof. What I just told you, a work in progress, but we have, to use a legal terminology, circumstantial evidence. And the most important probably come from this, breastfeeding. You know, we know the property of breastfeeding does a lot of stuff and so on and so forth. It really help us, you know, to really develop the baby the right way. But one thing, if you study the composition of the breast milk, you see a left-hand side, this HMOs is not a healthcare business. It's a human monooligosaccharide. So they are sugars. There are tons of them in the breastfeeding, in the breast milk. Tons. Completely useless for nutrition of the baby. The baby cannot use it. So we spend a tremendous amount of work to put in the breast milk sugars that are totally useless for human nutrition. What they do there? They nourish the microbiome. That's the only thing that they do. And they nourish a specific part of the microbiome that we want there so that we stay healthy. And because of that, you know, this really helped the gut to really mature that training that I was telling you to develop this weaponry that can be deployed if and only when we are under serious attack. So when we call change of the microbiota, definitely there are two conditions that we really care. One is the composition of the microbiota, and the other one is the distribution of microbiota through our GI gut. The gut dysbiosis, again, it's something that we start now to have a grasp of what really it's important for. And again, we were under the impression, okay, this dysbiosis of the microbiota in the gut will have consequences just in the gut. So if you have inflammation, that's because of this low threshold, you will have inflammation in the gut. Now, if you will read that book that Susan mentioned there, one of my favorite quotes that I use all the time that I've come up with 5 years ago is that the gut is not like Las Vegas. What happened in the gut does not stay in the gut. It really can affect any tissue organ in your body. As a matter of fact, this has been the correlation that has been proved or with strong evidence, circumstantial evidence, if not proved yet, between the dysbiosis in the gut and human diseases. So, and this, we don't know if this is due to a direct effect to the microorganism or the byproducts like metabolites and so on and so forth. The matter of fact is that, you know, not only problem in the intestine, like, you know, this very, very severe inflammation the gut in the premies that we call necrotizing enterocolitis or inflammatory bowel diseases or IBS or GI cancer that is intuitive that can be related to gut dysbiosis. But we are talking about distance. So in other words, the production of these chemicals, these metabolites or these pro-inflammatory chemicals that we call cytokines that eventually can affect the heart, the liver, the brain, the prostate, the kidney, the lung, the islets in the pancreas, and so on and so forth. Seriously, it's been, there is no, you know, condition right now that is not being linked some way or another to the gut microbiome. We go all the way to even human behavior, linking some of the effect of these metabolites to depression, schizophrenia, autism, and so on and so forth. And again, this is quite intriguing if you think that you can be nuts just simply because your gut microbiome is off of balance. So it's an intriguing concept. And again, for example, in terms of food allergies, we know already that this balance that I was telling you, when you go off down balance and you have dysbiosis, becomes to be something that has been pretty much solidly proved. In this case, these are folks that if they are allergic, they have more of this bacteroidesis and less of the Clostridia, I say, and vice versa if they're healthy. And then we did a study, of a proof of concept in celiac disease in which we follow infant from birth, and we saw the same trend. So in other words, that the signature of the microbiome of this kid was very different than the one that we saw in normal kids. So there is something strange that happened, in other words, when you are at risk for a condition and then you eventually end up in that final destination in terms of the microbiome composition. What I told you so far is the homework that we have done, to try to understand what this microbiome does for us. And again, simply what I present to you is what we call association. There is one disease, there is another cohort of people healthy. We look at the microbiome of people in the disease, we look at the microbiome of the one healthy, and then we do a leap of faith and say there are differences, and therefore maybe that this microbiota is different than one disease is the one that's causing the problem. But you know what? Correlation does not always mean causation. If we will believe that correlation is enough to say there is a cause-effect relationship, then guess what? This is a correlation between chocolate consumption and Nobel Prize laureates. The correlation is extremely significant, meaning the more chocolate you eat, the more the chance that you win the Nobel Prize. And that's the reason why in Switzerland is so high. Or, for example, there is a direct correlation between the amount of fresh lemon imported in the United States and the highway fatality in the United States. This correlation is huge. But it's hard to believe that the more lemons will come from Mexico, the less we die on highways. So there is no such a thing. There is a way that we need to really do to move from association to causation. And again, this is just to give you a roadmap of what we're doing right now. And I don't want to go into these details, but it suffices to say, technically feasible to move from the left-hand side association to right-hand side to causation. And this involves complicated homework that needs to be done. We can't take shortcuts here because I know there is a tremendous pressure to say, okay, now that you've done all this, what is the solution? What kind of probiotics I should take? We are not quite there yet. And again, rushing can reach the paradox results of vilifying something that can be extremely powerful. And, again, discussing this matter before, I really believe that we're making the mistake that we made with antibiotics now, with probiotics nowadays. When penicillin was discovered by Fleming, we thought that was the panacea to resolve all the infections. See what disaster we created by this promiscuous use of penicillin. We know now that not all microorganisms are sensitive to that. We know that the promiscuous use will make even the ones who are sensitive non-sensitive anymore because they develop resistance. I'm afraid that we're going to end up to do the same with probiotics if we promiscuously use them without having a design, customized approach that we may eventually have. Now, again, I don't want to, this is way too technical, but this is just to give an example that going back to that, proof of concept of this study in kids with celiac disease, we found out that kids that develop autoimmunity, matter of fact, we had kids that develop celiac disease or type 1 diabetes in this cohort, because, the two, they kind of travel together. They had a specific signature profile of some metabolites that appeared months before that eventually they end up to develop autoimmunity. It's like a flag that we saw preceding the onset of the disease. Again, association, no causation. But now, with some very unique and new techniques that, you know, we can, you know, now develop in the lab, i.e. taking an intestine from an individual during an endoscopy, a piece of intestine through the biopsy, growing a sort of artificial intestine, and now interrogate the system and try to figure out, if I take these metabolites that I saw before the onset of disease and I put on this system that I, you know, generate from an individual with celiac disease, can I eventually instigate the onset of the autoimmunity? And the answer is yes, you can. So, meaning that now we have the tool to move from association and causation. Is it going to be a long journey? But it steps and needs to be done if we want to cash on what is going on here. So, to wrap it up, you know, you, I, everybody spend a lot of money of our, you know, portion of tax that we gave to the government to really try to understand how we can really more efficiently treat, you know, conditions that are afflicting humankind. And when we start this journey, we start with the premises that we are the most sophisticated being on the face of the earth. We were convinced about this. When the Human Genome Project was completed, it was a major disappointment. My self-esteem went really to the toilet, learning that we are, by far, not by a little bit, by far, the most rudimental genetic being on the face of Earth. Only 25,000 genes. That's all. The worm that we go fishing with, 75,000, three times more than we do. The plant that make gluten, 150,000. So we, genetically speaking, are at the bottom of the evolution. There are a couple books that I strongly suggest you to read that will tell you how unplanned was the fact that we would be the dominating species on the face of the earth. Not just the meteor shower that wiped out the dinosaurs. There was much more than that. So we were not planned to be sitting here and talk. Other species were supposed to. But that's how evolution works. We are with these unforeseen events. And by the way, of these 25,000 genes, 99.98% identical to chimpanzee. Only 400 genes make the difference between us and chimpanzees. And I work with chimpanzees. Can talk with chimpanzees about Donald Trump and he's going to be a good president or not. They do not answer to me. And again, how do you explain this complexity if other than the fact that we took out of the equation for a long time the fact that we are really the composition of the two worlds that come together? That we thought they came together at birth, but this imprint in the microbiome, believe it or not, starts in the wound. So we really are made by two genomes. The human genome that we knew from a long time, come from mom and dad. If there is a defect in this genome, it can't do anything. It's there. But if this defect would become clinical reality or not, depends on this other guy here. This other parallel genome that is much more plastic. They change over time. If we're lucky, come from our mothers. Why? Because they select the good microbiome, the one that live in peace with her gene and most likely with our gene. But if we're born by C-section, the chance that we develop an autoimmunity like type 1 diabetes or celiac disease, five times more. Just the fact that we're born by C-section. And again, there is a rational why. You know, here you see in green the microbiome in the mouth of the mother just as an example. If you're born by vaginal delivery, the pink, you know, spheres, your microbiome is much more closely related to mom's vaginal and fecal microbiome. This microbiome has been highly selected by mom to stay there. It's not random. It's something that she really worked on and decided you can stay or you cannot. Conversely, if you're born by C-section, light blue, it's the skin microbiome, all comers. That comes on the skin of the mom. So they can be good guys or can be bad guys. And that's the reason why probably we develop, you know, these problems. So bottom line, imagine the human genome as a sort of piano with 20, 25,000 genes, meaning 20, 25,000 notes. And let's say that you have to strike 300 notes to play the song, celiac disease, or Alzheimer's, or breast cancer, whatever it is. The fact that you have that notes doesn't mean that you play that song. It's up to the piano player. that is in the microbiome that is extremely dynamic, as I told you. And if everything goes well, you may have the good microbiome, let's say Elton John that plays, you know, pop music, touch 200 or 300 notes, you don't develop the problem. So it's not a question of genetics. It's a question of lifestyle, because if you do something that makes the piano player to be changed, you travel to China, or you go to Mexico, got drunk there, Cancun, or you abuse with antibiotics, you eat in an inappropriate way, anything that can change the microbiome composition, now you can have Chopin sitting there. He's a virtuoso. He can touch 300 notes, and you develop the problem. And that explains the inexplicable. Why somebody that's been smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day for 20 years would not develop lung cancer, somebody never touched anything will. Of course, there is an increased risk because we know that smoke can increase the risk. But again, it's not enough. There's got to be something else. So the future is really to understand all this. And we can now, as I told you, have a possibility to understand who is playing the piano way before that the problem will materialize by looking at this metabolites, the kind of music that is played, what we call the metabolome. So if we hear pop music, we know that the good microbiome is there. We're okay. But as soon as we see that classic music is played, sooner or later, that problem on that specific genetic background will materialize. And that's what we've been entrusted by the NIH with this study that is called the Celiac Disease Genome Environmental Microbiome Metabolomic Study, or CDGEM for short, that is doing just that. Take these kids at risk from birth, follow over time, and trying to really create a model in looking at this multi-omic analysis. It will say, if you have that particular genes, and you have this particular microbiome that expresses those genes, and you have that metabolite, your risk is 90%. So I got to intervene. That is the time to think about customizing prebiotics, probiotics, symbiotics, whatever it is. Because, of course, we can't change the gene of the host, but we can change the microbiome and the way that it acts. I'm going to finish up to talk about this other problem that is, not dysbiosis, but different regional distribution of the microorganism, what we call bacterial overgrowth. And this has been linked to many problems, particularly metabolic diseases like fatty liver, obesity, type 2 diabetes, or intestinal disorders that you see the list there. And again, we don't know exactly how that happened, but probably it's microbiome and host metabolism, including this, what we call endotoxin, LPS, that can create the story there. It suffices to say that this metabolic disorder has been linked to many, 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 many conditions for which, for example, are black box, clinically speaking, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, autism, arteriosclerosis that still we don't understand fully other than, lifestyle, why, again, some people materialize and some not. And again, we start now to have a syndicate understanding of how this really translate in actuality. And again, I'm going to put this just to impress you and to say simply, remember how we started this discussion. It's the training of the microbiota that eventually will syndicate all this and will create a situation, not only because of dysbiosis, but because inappropriate distribution in the gut that you develop this problem. And let me finish with this very controversial question of microbiome, leaky gut, disease status, obesity, fatty liver, and diabetes. And the rationale stemmed from the observation that was, again, observational, on increase in intestine permeability to be associated with gut inflammatory tone, development of obesity, fatty liver, and so on and so forth. And here, in the last 2-3 years, just 2 or 3 papers that really, really summarize the story. So you see gut microbiota, intestine permeability, obesity, intestine permeability in obese patients correlated with metabolic syndrome, nutrition, intestine permeability, and fatty liver, zonulin, this molecule that makes intestine to leak, and marked intestine permeability, increased association, obesity, blah, blah, blah. All this to say, there is now a sense that is something that's going on here. But at the same time, I don't want to simplify the matter by saying, oh, you know what? We fix the leaky gut and we fix the obesity problem. No, there is also something that we have to do. If we will continue to have that kind of attitude, of course the obesity will not go away. Okay? There is no brainer that, you know, the obesity will require a lifestyle, an active part from us as an individual to not do these silly things here. Okay? And the other thing that I want to tell you is it goes both ways. And I'm going to finish up with something that's extremely dear to me. And it's probably in the smash of the Commonwealth Club philosophy to really have open discussion of stuff that really touch us directly or indirectly as human beings. Because, you know, again, what really killed me is the fact that if I was from Mars and I would look down here, I would observe the following. We spend $40 billion to overfeed ourselves. 40. We spend $30 billion to make sure that we have commercials that will push us to eat more. So we're 70. We spend $50 billion to go to the gym and lose that excessive weight that we're perpetuating on ourselves. $120 billion. And then there is another part of us that are dying of starvation. And that starvation can be solved with one-tenth of what we do in the quote-unquote civilized, you know, hemisphere. I $12 billion and famine will be resolved. As a Martian, looking down, I say, you guys are dumb. Why you do that? Why you do that? I don't need that. Consider also, not only that we overfeed ourselves, we trash, completely trash, 30% of the food that we produce. Trashed. In the garbage. And this is really something that unacceptable. Now look at these kids. These kids are affected by a condition that's called environmental enteropathy. They are stunted. It's not just a question of aesthetic. Their brain doesn't grow well. They don't reach that level of, you know, IQ to make these countries independent from us. They will be always subjected to us as people that will go there as colonizers and help them. The many, many nonprofit organizations have been trying to really resolve this problem, including the Gates Foundation, which I have the privilege to work with. And they said, okay, this is malnutrition. It's malnutrition-driven. Let's feed these kids more, an adequate amount of calories. We did. What was the solution? What was the outcome? A little bit of improvement, but they still are short. They still have a low IQ. Why? Because they have this condition that we call environmental enteropathy. There is this sort of vicious loop. They have, bottom line, this leaky gut, endotoxin that come in, inflammation is created, and now they have a damaged intestine that very much resembles celiac disease. So now you feed them appropriately, but they have a gut that cannot make use of it. So that is something that we desperately need to resolve. Why? Because it's the right things to do. You know, in Europe now, there are cries why these people, they are leaving their countries and they come to Europe and so on and so forth. These people are desperate. They don't have anything else left. There are this, and again, I don't want to do a political, you know, the discussion here, but how uncivilized we are now in building walls so that these people, they cannot come anymore because we want, quote-unquote, protect our privileges. And then, you know, the ISIS problem surge. These are byproducts of the fact that we don't take care of ourselves as a society as we should. Because if we will have a little bit the attitude of the microbiome, that, by the way, they are not selfish. They work for the community. They really work for the community. The microbiome change all the time and adapt very fast. And the primary goal for them is the conservation of the species. Some of them will die for that, so that the next generation can survive and adapt to the better world. If we took the lesson for the microbiome, we will be a much better society. As a matter of fact, I believe that the best way to really to move forward is to predict the future. If you want to predict the future, you better create it. And we have now the power to do that. It's just a matter of willingness to do that. Not coming from the top, but from the ground. It's totally up to us. I want to finish by saying, look, I'm simply a messenger. The science that you heard come from a dedicated group of individuals that have the privilege to really direct at the MGH, Harvard Medical School. These are people that are really put their professional life with very little pay to really for intellectual curiosity to achieve the goal that I was telling you. And with that, I will finish, and thank you so much for having me today.
First question is, what can adults do to decrease the chance of developing autoimmune disorder, for example, diet, etc.?
I think that I don't have a magic potion, but I think that, again, until we will be able to have a more evidence-based customized intervention, my word of wisdom is the following. The more we depart from the lifestyle that we evolved as a species, the more likely we'll be in trouble. You know, our ancestors, and not long time ago, were used to eat fruits, vegetables, lean meat, because these animals were running around to avoid the predators, fish, tubers, nuts. The more you depart from that diet, the more likely you're going to develop chronic inflammatory disease, including autoimmune diseases. So in other words, what I describe is pretty much the Mediterranean diet.
Next question. Is there a test to determine levels of good and bad gut bacteria so a person knows what to do next?
Not yet. This is, again, it's a work in progress. As I was telling you when I show you the hierarchy, there are some commercial labs that now they start to, quote-unquote, you know, study the microbiome and claim that they can tell you what kind of microbiome you have. But we're talking about at the phylum level, and it's just telling us, you know, who is in the Milky Way. But we don't know the actual evidence, and most important, we don't know what they're doing for a living. In other words, what kind of language they talk about. So until we reach that level, I don't think there is anything quite yet that, you know, we can use to eventually manipulate our microbiome.
Next question. If one destroys the gut biome with antibiotics, what is the best way to rebuild a healthy biome? And also, if an appendix is removed, how does one address this?
So I love this because, again, I have to say that the consequence of the disturbance of the microbiome by antibiotic treatment, we didn't know until the recent past. Folks not far from here, from WashU, Jeff Gordon has been, you know, a pioneer in the field. It showed that one course of antibiotic can change the microbiome composition. It would take months for this microbiome to go back to balance. Months, not weeks, not days, months. What that means, that if you have the needs to take the antibiotics because you have meningitis, by all means, you got to do it. Or pneumonia, you got to do it. But if we do what we do right now, particularly in kids, where 95% of infections are viral, and yet we give antibiotics because, you know, just want to be covered or because, you know, possible superinfections, I would think twice to do that. Best way to really balance and counterbalance that, once again, back to the lifestyle. You know, feed the proper things to yourself. And try to be, you know, not extreme. I don't like, you know, promote, you know, extreme diets for which we don't have any, scientific, you know, ground to justify that X, Y, or Z. It's just common sense, guys, common sense. Unfortunately, the problem with the appendix is we thought that was useless. And matter of fact, we went, you know, in the past two generations, this trend to take the appendix out. And, you have a stomachache, nothing to found, open it up, even if it's normal, take it out. Well, guess what? If Mother Nature put something in there like the tonsils or the appendix, got to have a function. And finally, we understood what this function is. And the appendix has a tremendous role to be sort of thermostat and for the microbiome. When it's gone, of course. And again, once again, how do you counterbalance that? Good lifestyle. Unfortunately, I can't give any better word of wisdom at this point.
Okay. Speaking of lifestyle, the next question is to address supplements. And what can one do to maximize the health?
I believe that, you know, supplements will be justified. When we talk about supplements, when we talk about multivitamins and minerals, provided, again, we don't have access to fresh food. Personally, and I'm not saying that you have to embrace my lifestyle. I don't take routinely supplements. I go to the market on Saturday morning, and I buy a bulk of fruits and vegetables that will be good for the rest of the week. I have a busy life. I go back home at 8, but stay reassured, by 8:30, food is on the table. And I cook because I enjoy to do that. I don't clean because it's painful, but I cook. And again, can be done. Of course, you know, more sophisticated, you know, dishes will require more time. So you want to do that on the weekend. Or you can do stuff and put it in the freezer. But the vast majority of good food can materialize relatively in a short period of time. And personally, for that reason, I rather prefer to have an orange that take the polyvitamins, because in that orange, I have all the vitamins that I need, all the minerals that I need, and that's fresh. You know, it's biologically active. But again, this is my personal advice. I mean, my personal lifestyle. But again, I don't think anything wrong to take, you know, supplements at all.
What about soil depletion? And there's less minerals and vitamins in our food.
Yeah, that's another issue. And once again, this goes back to tremendous change in lifestyle that materializes in a relatively short period of time. You know, we see quite often, you know, sodium depletion in situation for which then materializes with chronic fatigue syndrome and chronic cramps and muscle, you know, weakness and so on and so forth. You know, this is pretty much a deja vu, like the lack of iodine, for example, in the past that they have gouts and so on and so forth. I believe that, again, a common sense would call with a simple rule that is the following: how my grandmother used to cook and eat. I'm not talking about 2 generations ago. It will come to a surprise to you that 3 generations ago, the refrigerator did not exist. Did not exist. So we are not talking about the caveman 3 generations ago. So imagine the major lifestyle change that is materializing 3 generations. And I'm telling the refrigerator, I'm not telling you the freezer, I'm not telling you the microwave. For example, my daughter has the sense that cooking is how long it needs to be in the microwave. That's her sense of cooking. And imagine what this has done to us. Or, for example, some of you guys are too young to remember, but, you know, there were seasonality stuff that we ate. You know, you want strawberries? July and August. February strawberries? No way. No way. Now we have strawberries all year round. The same color, the same size. And you wonder where they come from and what they're doing to me. And if they come from somewhere else, you know, these strawberries, they have a microorganism on them. This is a microbiome that I've been now exposed to. Now it's coming from Mexico or South Korea, whatever it is. How this will impinge on my well-being in the long run? How will my rest of the microbiome accept or welcome strangers coming in? And if they do not, and they got in a fight, how this really impinge on me as an individual? So think about all this. And of course, some stuff cannot be avoided, guys. I don't want, again, give you the wrong impression that my message is we have to go back 3 generations. You know, imagine if I would tell you from now on, we're not going to use cell phone because otherwise we all will end up with brain, you know, tumor. Who would do that? Or we don't use the car because the pollution will kill them all. The common sense is, okay, I use the cell phone to communicate 30 seconds and then hang up. Or the car. I make sure that I use the car only when I really need it and make sure that I minimize the pollution. So, same story. Of course, you know, the way that we embrace our lifestyle, the way that we cook and we eat and so on and so forth, common sense, non-extreme, common sense.
What causes non-celiac gluten sensitivity?
Don't know. It's the short answer. We didn't know about this condition until the recent past. But, you know, we now have a hint that is an immune response that is not allergic like with allergy, is not autoimmune like celiac disease, yet is an immune response that in this individual they are predisposed, materialize with signs and symptoms that are not distinguishable for celiac disease or with allergy, matter of fact, but yet they need to go gluten-free in order to have their symptoms to be controlled. Until we don't identify and validate biomarkers, as we did 30 years ago with celiac disease or with allergy, it would be very difficult to answer the question. But, you know, we're making progress.
One of the members of the audience asked, because they've got a 2-month-old granddaughter, both parents have irritable bowel syndrome, that any suggestions to improve the risk for avoiding these problems in the child's future?
The genetic predisposition definitely there. You know, even from functional disorder like IBS, in which we thought there was mainly question of, you know, behavioral, you know, social issues, we know there is biology behind it. So definitely, we have started to learn a great deal about this IBS. Particularly, there are different forms of IBS. The IBS diarrhea, so in other words, the irritable bowel syndrome that is associated with diarrhea, has been indisputably strongly related, for example, to increased gut permeability. And there are some, you know, clinical trials in the making for something to block this, you know, loss of barrier function that can help. In general, once again, I hate to repeat myself, it goes back to a question of lifestyle. If we are in epidemics of this condition, including IBS, then it must be a way, by reading the book of evolution, how we can not only stop, but rewind the tape and go back where we started, possibly.
What is your sense how genetically modified organisms fit into this?
Okay, GMOs clearly is one of the things that have been changing the landscape here. I'm not sure how much they play the role in all this, and the reason why I'm saying I'm not an agronomer, by the way, is because the Institute of Medicine of the Academy of Science really had a question on the table, invited a few of us almost a year ago now in Washington, D.C., to discuss the matter. You will be surprised how little GMOs there are around. For example, wheat, no GMOs, they are commercially available. Zero. Maize, yes, but not wheat. In Europe, the GMOs are not allowed, yet they have the same epidemics that we do. Does this mean that GMOs are completely off the hook? Probably not. Probably they have some role, but is not the major, you know, culprit, in my humble opinion, in really causing these epidemics. It has very much to do with our lifestyle. I'll give you an example. The difference of autism between New Jersey and Delaware, they are side by side, a 50-fold difference. We're talking about a few miles, 50-fold difference. So definitely they eat the same stuff, or, you know, if there was GMO involved. Got to be something else in the environment, pollution, radiation, stuff that industry put in the pipeline of water. God knows what the heck we're doing to ourselves that is driving this epidemic. So be aware that, again, you know, we don't have a single culprit that can really do this all. We have to be mindful that it can be different environmental triggers that can eventually impinge on us. My biased view is that all this, they got in this bottleneck on the microbiome, because no matter what you're talking about, GMOs, radiation, pollutant, chemicals, they all, we know, affect the composition of the microbiome.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for speaking with us. And I, Susan Downs, as a member of the Health and Medicine Forum, adjourn this meeting.
Thank you.